The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
We're not going to look into motive, but we're going to look at Trump's actions objectively and evaluate, are these more like the actions of a candidate or are they more like the actions of a sitting president? And looking at that, the D.C. Circuit said, basically, this guy was acting as a candidate trying to win office and therefore no immunity.
It's the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Natalie Orpett, executive editor of Lawfare, with my colleagues, Lawfare senior editors Quinta Jurasek, Roger Parloff, and Alan Rosenstein.
Most of the conduct alleged in the indictment is not official. It's personal. Everyone seemed to agree that personal actions don't get any sort of immunity. But if that's the case, then this whole debate over exactly what sort of immunity does official conduct get is a bit beside the point, because even if they say, sure, the official conduct gets immunity, Jack Smith still has a ton of personal conduct that he could charge Trump with.
Today, we're bringing you our live discussion of Supreme Court oral argument in Trump v. United States, recorded yesterday, less than an hour after arguments concluded. This is the case asking whether former President Trump is immune from prosecution, and it arises out of special counsel Jack Smith's indictment of Trump in D.C. District Court for his alleged efforts to overturn the 2020 election.
Our executive editor, Natalie Orpett, is working on joining us. But in the meantime, while we're waiting for her to hop on, I think I know her first question was going to be asking us all for sort of our top line thoughts, takeaways, where our heads are at after the argument. I know my thoughts are confused. So Alan and Roger, let me go first to you. Alan, why don't you go first? And then I'll give myself the privilege of going last.
Sure. Where my head's at is in need of a lot of Advil. It was a very long oral argument. It was very spirited. It was extremely complicated. To be honest, I'm mostly confused as to where we are. I mean, I think we can say a couple of things. I think that those who thought that this would be a quick and easy affirming of the DC circuit, those people are almost certainly incorrect. There's clearly a lot of different views and a lot of justices on the conservative side in particular, maybe even five justices, who want there to be at least some degree of immunity for official acts. The question is what that means for this particular case, which we'll get into obviously later in the conversation. But I do think that this is clearly a real issue for the justices, and it will probably take some time, frankly, for the justices to write an opinion, given how many issues came up and how concerned a lot of the justices are about not making a decision that has these sort of unexpected consequences or bad consequences going forward. So yeah, this is not an easy case. This is not like, let's say, to make a comparison, the Colorado case, which was much more straightforward.
So those of you who are on Riverside just got Alan's super secret hidden answer for what his thoughts were. Roger, I'll go to you in a minute. Alan, what's the 20-second takeaway from what you just said for those who are listening on YouTube?
The 20-second takeaway is that this was extremely complicated. It was very long. It was extremely wide-ranging. And I just don't think we know where the justices are going to go. I think there's at least, there may very well be five justices that want some sort of degree of presidential immunity, criminal immunity for official acts, which means that this opinion will take some time to write, and it's not going to be the straightforward, we're just going to affirm the DC circuit that I think some commentators were thinking about. But really, unlike, you know, let's say the Colorado case, which was much more straightforward and much more predictable, I think this could go in all sorts of different directions. And it was a very long argument. And I think we'll just honestly need to spend some time peering through the transcript before we can really get a sense of where this is going.
Roger, what about you?
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. It was about 2 hours and 40 minutes. I do think, three of the justices, possibly four, would have been willing to affirm the D.C. Circuit. I don't know how the rest are going to. They did not seem very close to knowing what to do. Certainly five felt uncomfortable with certainly just affirming what happened. There was not enough protection for the president. And then breaking it down further, I think Brett Kavanaugh in particular, and to some extent Neil Gorsuch, wanted to give a very robust reading of something called the clear statement principle or clear statement rule. We can talk about that more. That would really limit what the prosecutions against a president, what kinds would be possible. And a huge question is, will this be sent back for more findings? And then the key question, would those findings themselves be appealable? And I think it makes it very unlikely that DC case will be tried before the election. So I think that's sort of a bottom line.
Yeah, I think I'm in the same place as both of you. I will say, over the course of that argument, I got progressively less certain about what anybody was arguing and where anybody stood. And with the exception of Michael Dreeben arguing for Jack Smith, who I think was extremely clear and sort of relentlessly nuanced, I would say, in what he was arguing. But at the end of the day, I think I'm less certain where the justices might end up, just because we seemed to move pretty far away from the core of the case, possibly just because Trump's arguments are so obviously absurd, and we can talk about that a little bit. I think at a certain point when Gorsuch was quizzing Dreeben, he made a comment along the lines of, oh, I'm not concerned about this case, or something like that, which seemed to me to kind of indicate this general sense that, you know, the justices were really thinking about what this might expand into, you know, what the slippery slope could look like if you take a few steps down it, but we're not necessarily concerned about the possible takeaways if they rule out immunity in this specific case, and that kind of gave the whole argument sort of an unmoored quality, I guess, in that we ended up spending a lot of time just sort of thinking through, you know, different spaghetti on the wall and different hypotheticals that weren't really related to this hypothetical. For some reason, Justice Kavanaugh pulled out Scalia's dissent in Morrison v. Olson and just started reading it, even though that has nothing to do with the facts of this case. So it was a journey. Let's say that
it was a bit of a 3 hour long, 9-person written law review performance.
Yeah. Well, so to avoid going too far into the weeds to begin with, I think it might be useful to kind of just give an overview of, you know, where we are, how we got here. So for those listeners who could maybe use a refresher, as I certainly could at this point, we've ended up here because Trump has essentially been arguing that the January 6th indictment impermissibly indicts him as a former president for official acts that he took as president, and that former presidents enjoy criminal immunity for those set of acts. The district court said no. It went up to the D.C. Circuit. The D.C. Circuit also said no. Both of those courts were sort of pretty strong in slapping those arguments down. And we appear to have Natalie. Natalie, I'm just giving us a brief overview of sort of how we got here, and then I'll hand it over to you. This now brings us to the Supreme Court. Jack Smith had originally tried to get this dealt with very, very quickly by asking the court to sort of hop over the D.C. Circuit and rule quickly. The court was not interested. And then they decided to weigh in after the D.C. Circuit ruling. And so here we are. And Roger, as you pointed to at the beginning, the undertone here is not just, you know, what will the justices rule, but will they rule in such a way as to allow the case to move forward before the election? And I think they're one of the sort of threads running through today was you saw a lot of back and forth, some with the justices just asking questions outright, some instances in which the justices were sort of clearly talking to each other by, you know, pretending to ask questions, sort of asking, you know, what will this look like if we pass it back to the district court? Does this need to go back to the D.C. Circuit for more appellate litigation, et cetera, et cetera. So that is where we are and how we got to the current moment. Natalie, should I pass it over to you?
Okay. I will add that my initial reaction, which may be duplicative of my colleagues, is that this was quite a whirlwind spaghetti at the wall sort of argument. And there's a lot to dig through. So I wanted to start with, I think, one of the very interesting line drawing exercises that the justices are clearly interested in, because, you know, I think we can skip over the notion that they were interested in spending a ton of time on absolute immunity, absolutely no exceptions to be made. And they went right into what are the situations in which immunity might not apply. So to do that, of course, they have to draw some lines between what types of conduct or what sorts of circumstances would lend themselves to prosecution or not, to a president's being prosecuted or not. I know, Alan, one of the ones that you have thought a lot about is this distinction, which one of the distinctions, line drawing exercises that the justices were testing, was this notion of private versus official conduct. So what did you make of the various discussions of that?
Yeah. So at some point, and this is particular when they were at the beginning of the argument, when they were talking to Trump's attorney, there were several justices, I think both on the liberal and conservative side, who asked a series of questions of the form, well, what about this conduct? Would this be personal or official? So for example, would picking up the phone and calling your personal lawyer to do a personal thing for you, would that be personal or official? And the response was, that's personal. And then they'd ask another thing and the advocate would concede that's personal. And this went down the line. And the reason that's important is because as the special counsel has argued, and actually here I'll reference a great post by Marty Lederman on Lawfare from a few weeks ago, actually most of the conduct alleged in the indictment is not official. It's personal. Everyone seemed to agree that personal actions don't get any sort of immunity. And the justices also seem pretty confident, I think at least five, that a lot of what's alleged in the indictment is personal. But if that's the case, then this whole debate over, at least in this case, exactly what sort of immunity does official conduct get is a bit beside the point. Because even if they say, sure, the official conduct gets immunity, Jack Smith still has a ton of personal conduct that he could charge Trump with. Now, there's some nuance there because some of the personal conduct relates to the official conduct. And so can you bring in the official conduct as part of establishing the personal conduct? The whole discussion did bring a bit of an air of unreality to the discussion, because you have a situation in which you have the actual case at hand, which is, can Jack Smith prosecute Trump for the list of things he's indicted him for? And everyone seems to agree that for most of it, the answer is yes. And then there's this other much more sort of theoretical, much harder question, it seems, for the justices about, for the subset of indictable offenses or indictable allegations that relate to official conduct, what precisely should the level of immunity be? And those seemed oddly disconnected throughout the whole opinion, throughout the whole argument, rather. And so I'm very curious how this will end up reflecting in the opinion and also in terms of whether or not the judges, the justices, remand to the district court to do a whole inquiry going, you know, line by line through the indictment and segregating the official acts from the unofficial personal acts.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And it does sort of lend some additional light on the question presented as the court framed it, which at the time it came out was sort of bewildering to us. But if you look back at it, the question is whether, and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve
official acts during his tenure in office. So that may speak to additional complexities that the justices were identifying in drawing those lines. Roger, did you have any thoughts on the official acts versus private acts distinction?
I think Alan's right that a lot of the justices did think you could send a lot of the case back, that a lot of the acts, and in fact, even John Sauer, the Trump's lawyer, conceded that certain acts, not all that many, but certain acts were private. I wasn't clear on whether people like Brett Kavanaugh were even going that far because of this extreme view of so-called clear statement doctrine. And I'd be interested how other people read that. But yeah, I think most were willing to send them back, but they didn't know what did that mean. How do you extract the others? Do you, Chief Justice Roberts said something like, even if you... What do you do? Do you expunge the other counts from the record? But it's part of an integral. In fact, the conduct of behavior and the analogy he gave, which was a good one, was bribery, which is like if the president can be prosecuted for anything, it has to be bribery because it's right in the Constitution. It's one of the impeachable offenses, and the phrase is. And if convicted, you can be then prosecuted for it. So he said that's there's some case law that says, well, that's private. But obviously it's you do it. It's an abuse of your official position. It is an official act. So if you're being paid to make somebody an ambassador and you're saying, okay, we take out the official half of it, what does it mean? Somebody gave you $1 million, but you can't tell the jury for what. So how does that work? So they seemed to be a little stumped there, but maybe they can. One suggestion was that you can go forward with these charges, and you would simply instruct the jury. Okay, don't. You can hear about what Trump said to the vice president. You can hear about what Trump did in threatening to replace the acting attorney general with another guy, but you can't hold that against him. You can use that only as evidence of the other that the other conspiracies were real. So it's possible it'll play out like that. And then there was another shade of distinction that was brought in, and it wasn't clear whether it was necessary, but there were distinctions between among official acts, like there's core official and there's non-core official, core to the president's function. And that might really, really be immune. And Dreeben seemed to almost concede that. I think he sort of conceded that. He wanted a different framework of analysis, but he sort of conceded that. But anyway, that's what I got out of this.
Yeah, and I think to your point about the sort of subset of official acts, I will also point listeners to an article that we published by Trevor Morrison, which digs in very much on this question of whether there can be immunity for certain types of conduct, but not others, even within the broader heading of official. And the argument that he makes is that simply because it is a presidential authority or a presidential act doesn't render it automatically absolutely immune. But there may be more immunity or more automatic immunity if the act is undertaken as part of the president's exclusive Article II authorities. So you should read his piece because it is much more in depth about that point. Quinto, what were your thoughts on either this particular line drawing exercise between official acts and private acts, or between any of the other line drawing efforts that the justices raised?
Just on Sauer's argument, I will say I was really struck by how enamored he suddenly seemed of the D.C. Circuit's opinion in Blasingham. So that's the a case regarding Trump's civil liability for January 6th, in which the D.C. Circuit kind of took the framework from Nixon v. Fitzgerald, which said that the president has immunity within the outer perimeter of his official responsibilities, and then said, okay, well, how do we apply that to the situation of January 6th? What we're going to do is we're going to engage in we're going to look at the facts. We're not going to look into motive, but we're going to look at Trump's actions objectively and evaluate, are these more like the actions of a candidate or are they more like the actions of a sitting president? And looking at that, the D.C. Circuit said this guy was acting as a candidate trying to win office and therefore no immunity. Going back and looking at the briefing, Blassingham pops up a couple times in Trump's briefing before the Supreme Court, but basically just as they're like, yeah, if you want, you could look at Blassingham, but really we think he should just have absolute total immunity. But he doesn't really rely on it. But he really, really kept going back to Blassingham during oral argument as a way of distinguishing between personal and official acts. Sometimes I will confess in ways that I didn't entirely follow, but he really did seem to be kind of honing in on that as a structure that the justices might be interested in following. I think the twist was that there were then all of these kinds of weird instances where he would say, oh, well, you know, we have the Blassingham structure, but even within that, there's a question of, okay, you know, how do you evaluate candidate versus official. And we ended up with this sort of bizarre back and forth between him and Justice Kagan, where Kagan said, okay, you know, what if the president ordered the staging of a coup to stay in office? And Sauer said, well, it would depend if it was an official act.
And then at some point, Kagan said, that sounds bad, which is never something you want to hear.
Yeah, literally those were her words. That sounds pretty bad.
Nice moment.
So I think that kind of points to how Blassingham is really only going to get him so far here. But I did find that striking in how he seemed to be relying on that, in part also because of how Blassingham kind of contrasts with a different approach that the D.C. Circuit took in this case, where it basically didn't even touch that because it just said, you know, no immunity, we're done, goodbye. And so it's a more complicated framework, which seemed to maybe appeal to some of the justices. It also is good for Sauer in terms of delay because it means that he can say, oh, I mean, Blassingham, like, man, we really gotta remand, you gotta hash this out, we gotta figure this out pre-trial, right? So which I think makes sense if you think of his goal as to stretch things out.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanna say I am perhaps a little more sympathetic to the parade of crazy hypotheticals that the justices went through than I think the rest of you might be. And I will say, you know, having read Nixon versus Fitzgerald, which is really the core immunity case, about 20 times now because of stuff I've been writing for Lawfare and trying to make sense of it, I am very, very sensitive to how the court really only gets a crack at this issue once every few decades. And that what it says and how it says it will have enormous, enormous implications going forward. You know, I'll be honest, I was always somewhat, while I understood the criticism of the court in terms of delay, I was always a bit puzzled by those who didn't think the court should even grant cert on this. It's an incredibly important issue. The line drawing is very, very complicated. The background immunity doctrine, frankly, doesn't make a lot of sense. And I wrote a Lawfare piece to that effect a few weeks ago, if folks are interested. While I think ultimately Trump should lose on these specific immunity arguments, I do think that an answer that resolves this case, but is also workable, again, not just for the next time a president is indicted, and that probably, hopefully, is not going to happen too often, but for all the ancillary implications that OLC will, for example, deal with, is very, very complicated. And so, you know, when Justice Kavanaugh goes on sort of a long rant, on the one hand, it's a bit much. On the other hand, I really do understand where he's coming from. And I would just urge everyone to recognize that this is not an easy opinion to write if you're trying to do more than just dispose of this specific case. And honestly, it's kind of this court's job to also provide some guidance for the future. And I think that's actually very difficult in this case.
Quirin, decide first, figure out the reasoning later.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
So you wouldn't be in favor of a Bush v. Gore style opinion limiting it to
yeah,
the circumstances?
I think anytime the court says nothing applies beyond the four corners of this case, that's a pretty good sign that that they're not doing the job we paid them to do.
I think that what Alan has just set out is part of why this case is so frustrating. And what I mean by that is that when the D.C. Circuit handed down its ruling in this case in, I want to say, was that early February? There were a lot of people, I think possibly everyone who's currently here included, who said, wow, what a great opinion. You know, the court should just allow this to stand. They don't need to hear the case. Keep it moving, right? And the court decided to hear the case. And there was a lot of discussion about why that was. And one of the theories that was put out there was essentially, if you want to put it nicely, that the justices, you know, wanted to engage in their constitutional role and you know, be the last word on this issue. That's their responsibility. And if you want to put it not so nicely, that they think they're very important and they think they're very smart and they want everyone to know how smart and important they are. And therefore, they wanted to hear the case. And I do think that there is this kind of push and pull between what I would argue are, you know, the constitutional urgency of deciding this question as soon as humanly possible. Because, frankly speaking, if you don't, there is a good question about whether the Supreme Court in its current form will persist along with the rest of American constitutional democracy in the coming years versus the kind of typical Supreme Court's approach of, you know, the nine sages who sit on high, you know, thinking through these important legal questions, not only now, as Alan says, but like, but for the future. And yes, that is important. And I think what I'm trying to say here is that in order to have those questions answered in such a way as to, you know, think through these important issues for the future, you need to have a constitutional future in the first place. And my worry is that they are so high up in the clouds that they do not realize or do not care or have a unearned level of confidence in the ability of their own institution to persist, let's say, that may end up undermining this whole endeavor. I don't know. Is that unfair?
No, I mean, I think it raised for me the irony of one of the part of the policy discussion at one point about what implications this would have for how a president chooses to conduct him or herself in office is, well, wouldn't a president just choose to pardon himself for everything he might have possibly done that would be criminal? And I mean, you know, the outcome of this case is going to affect perhaps an election that is coming up. So that's sort of an interesting inquiry as we are thinking about the future of democracy, as Quinta says. Roger, sorry, go ahead.
No, I didn't want to. I had other unrelated points, but I think, you know, Quinta was making a very good point about, yeah, if you're looking about, you want to make sure we have this right for 20 years down the road, you want to make sure, you know, that there is a 20 years down the road for this country. And they might be losing track of that. Taking some other issues sort of out of a hat, because that's the way they came in, you know. I think Clarence Thomas also asked about, have you challenged the special prosecutor here? They hadn't. Then there's this clear statement rule, which is something that was not mentioned before Chutkan on this, certainly not in this motion. It wasn't mentioned, I don't think, at the D.C. Circuit, but it was raised here. It was raised before Chutkan indirectly in a different motion. And clear statement rule is, or principle, is something that, frankly, I never heard of until I came to Lawfare. I was practiced, and I went to good schools, and I was, you know, exposed to stuff, constitutional law, for 20 years. And it's this weird notion, the extreme notion, which Brett Kavanaugh seemed to be taking very seriously, was that some notion like you can't prosecute a president unless the particular statute says you can prosecute presidents, by the way, with this statute. Now, I think that's a crazy interpretation of anything that's ever happened. But I think there are two rulings that don't have to, they aren't criminal, they're civil, he is taking that one. There's only two statutes that do name the president in that way. And Gorsuch seemed to be taking this seriously too, and he mischaracterized one of those two statutes. You know, it's a statute about soliciting funds and being when you're inside a government building. You know, if you remember once Al Gore was soliciting funds and he took his mobile phone and reached out a window so he wouldn't be violating this, and that's the statute they're talking about. So you would be wiping out, you know, this whole notion that the president is not above the law, you would be wiping that out. And no, so fortunately, I think it's only Kavanaugh, and hopefully I'm mischaracterizing what he was saying and thinking. But anyway, there's that. And another thing that was interesting was when they started talking about state prosecutions, I thought Dreeben was very open to the idea that maybe those were, that maybe the president was immune. I noticed Chutkan in the same thing, that they really care, you know, if states are going to go after presidents, they're sort of open to the idea that the president might be immune to that in a more categorical way. And I think it's from a real distrust of, you know, not unreasonable. A lot of state prosecutors are elected officials, and it's a different system, and they're worried about that. So I noticed that. Those are just some stray observations.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the state issue that they cabined that pretty quickly too, but that seems like an issue of supremacy clause immunity rather than this broader question of immunity from criminal prosecution at the federal level. But on your point about the clear statement rule, which I, much like you, think I had read a stray article here or there and promptly forgot about the clear statement rule after concluding that only OLC cared about it. Which was clearly wrong because the justices now care quite a lot. You know, what's interesting is that, as you said, was raised in a separate brief by Trump. It was not included in this argument and this case as it got presented to the Supreme Court. So as I think Dreeben identified, they sort of smuggled that argument in here. But the way that it came up was in their other motion to dismiss. How it came up originally, I should say, was in their other motion to dismiss filed at the same time in district court that was on a statutory basis for dismissing the case. And that sort of gets to me to one of the things that I thought was interesting about the ping-ponging here between things, because it seemed to me that all of the discussion of the clear statement rule was really a question of when we see an indictment of a president, do we look first at the statutes that he is being charged under and decide whether he can't be charged because those statutes don't apply to the president? Or when we are looking at an indictment, do we have to do more of a fact-specific analysis, of course, at a motion to dismiss phase, treating all of the allegations as true, and decide whether those allegations relate to public or private conduct or relate to office seeker versus office holder? And those are really two different ways of addressing the question of whether, you know, the ultimate question of can this case survive? Can this indictment against a president survive a motion to dismiss? But Quinta, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, I will say I'm a veteran of the Mueller wars, and therefore, unfortunately, was very familiar with the clear statement rule because it showed up in the Mueller report as part of the argument about why whether or not the obstruction statutes apply to the president, a portion of the report that I think most people believe was written by Michael Dreeben. So every time is a flat circle. Here we are again. So, right. So for context, so yeah, so the clear statement rule is something that comes out of the Office of Legal Counsel. I think there is disagreement within OLC veterans as to how seriously to take it and how broadly it extends. Jack Goldsmith, who ran OLC for a time, has written in Lawfare sort of making what I think is fair to say is the more, the stronger assertion of how it should be interpreted when it comes to laws that would potentially limit presidential authority if they were to apply to the president. I will say, I think the thing that is important to understand here is that this came up a lot in the Mueller context because the obstruction that was at issue in the Mueller case had to do with what was, you know, really central acts of presidential power, like who should be the FBI director, right? Can the president call the attorney general and tell him to fire people? Sort of things that were really, really very much at the core. Whereas the conduct here is way farther out from that issue. And that is why I believe Dreeben at one point referenced specifically the bribery statute, precisely because OLC has said, oh yeah, you know, we're not like bribery, clearly that would apply to the president because the president, as you said, Roger, has no constitutional authority to engage in bribery to begin with. So it doesn't raise any constitutional problems to think about that statute as applying to the president. And so Dreeben kind of gets around all of this by saying, you know, there are no constitutional problems that are raised by applying these statutes to the president because he didn't have the authority to do these things to begin with, which is why we're prosecuting this case. And I think Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson kind of, there was a bit of an exchange where she dug into a bit how strange it is in some ways to address the clear statement rule in this context, because the whole point of the clear statement rule is to avoid a potential constitutional problem in terms of separation of powers, in terms of Congress regulating presidential conduct. Whereas this case, in Justice Jackson's phrasing, is about the constitutional questions. And so I don't know if I completely followed or agree with the way that she framed it, but that there is this sort of weird heads I win, tails you lose quality to kind of going back and forth between this constitutional avoidance argument on the one hand, and then, you know, attacking the constitutional issue head on.
It's hard to stay on a particular topic with this argument, but I think this is connected. I would say that Justice Alito was pointing out that there's a little bit of a semantic thing here that Dreeben would say there's no presidential immunity, but he would say there are a number of other ways that the president is protected in a unique way. And actually, eventually, Dreeben said there were core Article II functions that were pretty much immune. And then, and what he was arguing for, Dreeben, was a case-by-case analysis of the degree of conflict, if any, with Article II, that it would be posed by a prosecution. In some cases, you would construe statutes in a way as to avoid a constitutional conflict, which you would narrow the statute, say it couldn't be applied in this way. And so you sidle into a form of immunity. And so I think they were struggling to some extent with semantics. And in that vein, and in sort of a hopeful note, I would say that two-thirds, if not three-fourths, of the argument was conducted with Dreeben. And I think that was because John Sauer, because he was an advocate for Trump, he had no choice but to hold really crazy positions, as you just heard. You know, he did say that, yes, if a president ordered SEAL Team 6 to assassinate his rival, that might be an official act and would be protected. The military coup to extend the president's, you know, once you, that might be protected, once you say those things, the justices began to discuss these questions with the other side and try to work out, and the DOJ, and it, that was another weird exchange, and Quinta, correct me if I'm wrong, but at some point, one of the justices said, so, by the way, Mr. Dreeben, are you here for the special counsel's office, or are you here for DOJ? And I believe he said he was speaking for DOJ through the Solicitor General in this context. So, but it is true that DOJ has an interest in protecting the executive branch, including the president. They don't want, you know, to diminish the president's powers either. And what they were obviously unsatisfied with was that the D.C. Circuit placed a lot of emphasis on the fact that, well, you know, federal prosecutors have ethical standards that constrain their conduct, and you know, the attorney general oversees them, and there are grand juries that, you know, have to find probable cause, and then there's layer after layer of constitutional rights. A number of the justices, I think Chief Justice Roberts and Samuel Alito, were very uncomfortable thinking, they didn't think that was enough, that those were not realistic, especially the old, the grand juries, the grand jury will indict a ham sandwich sort of thing. Those were additional salient points to me. One last point was that, if you haven't mentioned it already, Ketanji Brown Jackson was very, very forceful about the flip side of these. You know, there was a lot of concern about, are you going to limit the president's power and will there be a cycle of vendettas? And she was looking at the other side. If you unleash, you know, the president from any criminal power, this is going to become a center of criminality, or have that potential. I'll look for that exact language, but I'll hand it back to Natalie for now.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say quickly, and then Quinta, I want to hear your thoughts too, on the sort of layers of safeguards, structural safeguards that you were referencing, Roger, don't worry too much about how this might play out because there are all these other controls that will make sure that a rogue prosecutor, for example, won't unjustly go after a president. You know, I kept thinking to myself during that whole argument, well, what safeguards exist against a president who would be given absolute immunity from everything to safeguard against just complete and utter abuse of power, which I think is exactly what Justice Jackson was getting at in that line that you were just referencing. Quinta, what were your thoughts on this?
I do think that the question of who Dreeben was representing is an interesting one. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds of like the intra-DOJ politics here, but I will say that it was notable that he presented himself as arguing, you know, speaking for the Justice Department, in particular because he emphasized later on, and I can't remember what the specific context was, but essentially, you know, he is speaking for the executive branch. Trump has kind of postured himself here, and Sauer kind of postured himself here as protecting the equities of the president. We have a sitting president. It's not Trump. The Justice Department operates under him, and the executive branch in this instance, you know, with the appropriate protections for DOJ independence, has made the decision which Dreeben is defending as the voice of the Justice Department in front of the Supreme Court, that this is conduct that should be prosecuted as criminal and that they are comfortable not being protected by immunity. And so I do think that that was kind of an important moment that Dreeben was able to really drive that point home.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in some ways it belied something that's been unspoken, which is that both sides are sort of purporting to speak on behalf of the interests of the executive branch. The Trump side is saying, well, if you don't find absolute immunity, it's going to have all of these chilling effects, and it's going to be a violation of the separation of powers, and it will have these, you know, parade of horrible effects on how future presidents conduct themselves. And so they want to portray the special counsel's office and Dreeben in this argument as speaking for a prosecutor who may, in fact, be this rogue prosecutor that we're all worried about. Whereas, you know, by indicating that, in fact, he's speaking for DOJ and as you said, Quinta, speaking on behalf of the equities of the executive branch and of DOJ, the special counsel's office is really claiming, no, we're the ones who are representing the interests of the presidency, which is just sort of an interesting distillation of some of the underlying principles with which each of them is posing their articles, and I think posing their arguments, and I think really gets to how the Supreme Court is going to think about its role in weighing these arguments against each other. One other quick question I wanted to get your thoughts on is, you know, one thing that has always interested me and that they spent some time on was this notion that there are cases providing that it is inappropriate to consider the motivation of the president in undertaking certain acts because, and that was in the context of broader discussions of how do you determine what is a public act or a private act or, you know, a office seeking or office holding act. And there's always been to me an interesting question which came up in another way actually as well, which was the do you decide immunity before digging into the specifics of what's in the indictment, or do you look at the indictment itself, even if that means, you know, the president, former president, will be subject to some litigation in connection with a prosecution, but can't be ultimately convicted because of immunity? There's always a complicated, what is the order of operations and when, what is the moment at which we start thinking about this doctrine? And it all gets very circular very quickly about how you are going to apply these different analyses and whether doing it one way violates another. So I'm just curious what you, now that I delivered that in as ping-pongy away as the entire argument went, if you guys have thoughts.
That's a key thing with immunity. Any immunity argument in either the civil or criminal context, you want to decide it early. You need to decide it early before you get, you know, into discovery and it becomes very expensive. And in the pleading, there will always be accusations of bad motive. And so ordinarily in other motions to dismiss, civil or criminal, you assume the truth of the allegations and say, is this legally sufficient? If you assume the truth, they will always have bad motive because it will always be a part of the pleading. And so they don't want to get into a test that involves motive because there's no way that's sort of a, you would need to go to trial or, and if you, to really determine it. And if you're just going to look at the pleading, there's always motive alleged. So what they did in Blasingame, which was a civil case against Trump by a police officer, was they looked for an objective standard that would at least work there. And they found this thing about, was he acting as an office holder or as an office seeker versus office holder. And there were objective indicia that almost everything in the complaint involved office seeking. And so that's why some people are militating in that direction here too, because most of the criminal stuff is about office seeking. There were other attempts at what standards might work that wouldn't sound just like you were looking into motive. Alito came up with the totally implausible standard. What if you're, I think it was something like that. What if the allegations, if you're saying it was an official act, but it's totally implausible that an official act could be used for that purpose. As Sotomayor pointed out, that really doesn't rule out a lot except for the SEAL Team 6 assassination attempt. I don't know if it would reach this indictment. And so that's something, they were really struggling with.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to the sort of absurdity of, or one might say, depending on which perspective you take, the absurdity or the necessity of thinking about this in the abstract rather than thinking about it as really looking at this particular case. Is this, that, and the other alleged fact in any way possibly an official act? But anyway, Quinta, go ahead.
I don't think I have a huge amount to add to that. I mean, I do think it underlines the sort of question of how you put this into practice, underlines the importance of how the court decides this should be dealt with on remand. Is this going to be something that's going to be hashed out as Jack Smith requested in the district court as part of, trial proceedings, evidentiary rulings, jury instructions, and so on? Or is this something that, we really need to have like a, whole back and forth with all these interlocutory appeals up to the DC Circuit and so on and so forth? It's not really clear. I think the justices seem to be struggling with that. Obviously, there's sort of a political valence in terms of what your preferred outcome would be. I don't know, if you strip away the election context, I'm not sure what is the sort of the best answer, so to speak. But it does, you do end up in this kind of weird situation. And I will be interested to see how they deal with that remand question, just in terms of things like, let's say, some of these might be official acts. Like, can you introduce evidence about that at all? Robert seemed to suggest no, which would lead to a very weird situation. Maybe you can introduce evidence, but it's, if you're not, that the charge itself isn't focused on that. It gets very weird very quickly.
Yeah, and questions about would the jury make these findings or must a judge make them beforehand and how would that work? So, yeah, we were really floating in no man's land there.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are up against time, but I think to round it out, what do we think? What does this mean for the future and particularly the timing of the underlying prosecution, which now feels so long ago, but remember how this case is actually about whether Trump violated various statutes by trying to overturn the 2020 election. Roger, what's going to happen? Are we going to ever see trial?
It's looking dim. My calculations were if we get a decision by June 1st, which seems unlikely, and there were no additional hurdles that could be appealable, you could get to trial and maybe get a verdict by October 26th, which would be about a week before election. If it comes out June 30th and there are no additional hurdles, you could not get a verdict before the election. And if you really want to feel bad, I would let you know that if they hadn't taken cert on February 28th, we'd be going to trial on May 28th, or we could, theoretically.
All right. Well, on that uplifting note, I think we will wrap it up there. But Roger and Quinta and Ellen in absentia, thanks very much for joining.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at our website, lawfaremedia.org/support. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th. Check out our written work at lawfaremedia.org. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our theme music is from Alibi Music. As always, thank you for listening.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.